PHP Radio
on the Hackers Paradise Podcast Network,
your number one source for all things golf.
Subscribe on iTunes to never miss an episode.
Hello, you golfing legends, and welcome back to another episode of the original Off Course. I'm your host, Dan Edwards, and joining me this week, much at my demand, I don't think so much at his, is Mr. Preston Toulon, the favorite son over there at Toulon Putters. What's going on, buddy?
I don't know if I'd say that, but good to finally be with you, Dan.
It's always a mix. It's either the third son or the favorite son. I can't figure that out. What? There's got to be a big story behind that.
No, there's not. Just sequentially, I'm the third son. I'm the baby. I don't know what that means for my standing as the favorite. I can't be number one. Everybody knows Joe's number one, and I, in terms of my dad's favorite, Tony and I just try not to come in last. So I know I'm at least not the favorite.
Well, it's an epic battle. I suppose working every day is either a blessing or a curse to try and level up in that regard.
It can be both.
Well, I thought it'd be really good to get you on because we've heard a lot from your dad, Sean, and we always love to have him on the show. It's always chaotic and awesome. But, you know, there's a lot more to the brand there, and he certainly spoke to it at the end of the show. It's a family thing that I think everyone there is really passionate about. So let's dig into you a bit, man. What's it like growing up as Sean's son? How was golf 20 years ago?
From a very young age, I had a golf club in my hands, sort of whether or not I wanted to or not. Some of that is my dad's passion that, you know, he absolutely, I think, envisioned at some point just a perfect foursome between him and his three boys. And in many respects, it's what we have pretty often. So from a very young age, I was playing golf. And he always worked in golf. So I remember as a kid, it was Zevo, the company he founded in the early 90s. And then at various times in my life, he had a year to Acushnet, which I don't know if people remember. That was when he was at Cobra, and that was under the Acushnet umbrella. And he's just like, Acushnet's great. My dad is not an Acushnet guy. He's a bit loose to be under that umbrella. And then he went back to TaylorMade in 2000. And then from 2000 to 2015, it was an unbelievable run there. So growing up as Sean's kid, I had a bunch of different clubs from a bunch of different manufacturers that were forced into my hands at all times. And then I'm the youngest of three boys. So my brother Joe's 2 years older than me, and Tony is 5.5 years older than me. So I was always, just sort of nipping at their heels too. So you sort of do when you're the baby brother, you sort of do what the bigger brothers do. So I just sort of did whatever they did. And we all got pretty good at golf, and we all remain pretty good at golf.
It's got to be a lot of fun to think back at those times. I've had, when you talk around the table or around the golf course, like, man, what would life be like if my dad was, a Major League Baseball player or, professional hockey player? I feel like you got a little bit of a taste of that because, being that close to golf for that much time, it had to have been a little bit curious. Like, you don't really realize the people he was engaging with when you were a kid until now. And you're like, holy, like that was my youth.
Yeah. I guess, I've honest to God, Dan, I've never even thought about it that way. It was just my life. And I guess, Ken Griffey Jr. was probably the same way growing up in Ken Griffey Sr.'s household. He was just going into the clubhouse every day, and that was probably normal. Like Mark King, I don't really think of him as anything other. He's basically my Uncle Mark. He was my, confirmation sponsor. He got kicked out of the church because he was talking too loud behind me during my confirmation, mass. So, I guess you don't really even realize it. And in many ways, that's the definition of taking things for granted, to the point where to this moment, I hadn't even thought about that. So yeah, the proximity to legendary equipment creators and then people who've fundamentally changed the golf industry, I definitely took it for granted. It's interesting, but those are, John Kawaja, Mark King, Jeff Letourneau, those are all, just people I grew up seeing every day. So yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's just really cool. Like, the household names for you are names that a lot of people really look up to in the industry. Yeah. And I have a feeling that whether intentional or not, molded the perspective you have on the game of golf and certainly around the equipment piece. So, you know, there is a gap that we will fill to discuss between that and being at Toulon now. But, you know, looking back through all of that, do you feel like now where you are being back in golf and being wholly invested in your brand, do you feel like there's a fulfillment or a wholeness that comes with that?
I don't know, Dan, how much people really know about me, but I quit golf for a long time because I honestly, golf was never my favorite sport growing up. My favorite sport to play was always basketball. My favorite sport to watch is baseball. It remains baseball. You can see behind me. It's the Arizona Diamondbacks. Literally off camera is the hat I was wearing that I took off before I jumped on with you to show off my freshly shaven head. But
come on, man. I'll get my Jay stuff out if you need me to. Like, we can make this a baseball podcast.
We can have a conversation.
Yeah.
We had a nice trade a couple years back. We got Gabby Moreno from
Hated it, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, Dalton Barshow actually was a Hillsboro Hop in the time I was there. So I spent a ton of time with Dalton while I was working at pro baseball. But so to go back to your point or to your question, and the reason I quit golf for about 8 or 9 years is, and I probably shouldn't even say this out loud, is I developed just probably the worst case of the yips of all time. So I would hit 14, 15 greens and I shoot 85, and I had just completely lost any joy that I can get from the game. I still remember, like, literally to this day, the very first time I yipped a putt. I was 14 years old playing in a tournament at Palm Desert, and I left a 4-foot putt, a foot short and a foot right, and it was just a complete involuntary jolt at impact. And it just sort of like crept in and got worse and worse and worse. And for a long time, I just associated, man, I hit the ball so good and I keep shooting 85. This just isn't that fun. So when I went away to college, I went to the University of Oregon. I didn't even bring my golf clubs. And part of that was I was just so sick of yipping it. And then there's just nothing worse to me than rain golf. Like, if as a person who just didn't love golf the way other people loved golf growing up, I certainly wasn't going to play in the rain. You know, you got to love golf to do that. So I when I moved back home after a long stint up in Oregon, that was when I sort of got back into it. And actually the way I got out of I overcame the yips was through Mark King. I flew home for Thanksgiving 1 year, and Mark King was my dad's next door neighbor for a long, long time. And Mark had a long Corza Ghost. If you remember that putter, it's still one of my favorite putters. Daniel Berger still using it, the one with the hole in the back of it. Mark had a long one that I didn't even bring my club. So I needed clubs. So I went down to Mark's garage and I found this long putter, and I brought it out that day. And then every putt, I just stuck it straight into my sternum. It just completely anchored. This was before they banned it. And I made everything. I'd never done it before. I made everything. I hadn't played in, you know, probably a year, and I shot like 75. You know, I've always been able to hit it okay. And I'm just looking to, if I can finish with like 35 or fewer putts, I'm happy, right? So that day I probably had like 30 or 31 and didn't hit it good because I hadn't been playing much, but it totally brought back the joy. And then a year later is when the USGA banned anchoring putters. And that's when I really felt like golf just wasn't for me, right?
Okay.
The one thing that I found finally, you know, able to help salvage a semblance of a golf career was gone. But then, you know, you mess around with grips, you go claw, you go left hand low and all that. And honestly, I've been pretty darn good for a very long time now. So I'm able to putt again and enjoy it. So I don't even remember what your question was, but I know I didn't answer it. So.
No, that's perfect. I mean, the goal here is to get some depth, and we certainly get that. Are you sure it wasn't when Mark King hooked your ears up to the riding lawnmower and zapped you a little bit? Isn't that like, that's what I feel like I need to do to get out of my yips. So if it's just a long putter, then maybe we bring those back.
Well, the thing is, like, the long putter never would have worked if I wasn't able to anchor it, you know?
Oh, okay. So,
and then the weirdest thing was, it'd probably been 8 years since playing competitive golf when I came back home, and then I signed up to play in the club championship at Shadow Ridge right down the road here. And I remember I was just like, I'd been playing good going into it, and I was so excited because I hadn't played any competitive golf, just excited to see what you could do, right? And I have like a 80-yard wedge shot into the first hole, and I hit it to 8 feet, but I hit it to 8 feet above the hole. And yeah. I'm just, like, it's my first competitive putt. like in nearly a decade. And I'm like, I'm shaking to pull the putter back. And I hit it, and I hit it 10 feet by, you know, so now I have 10 feet for par, and you're just so mad at yourself. And I just remember the putt back up the hill and uphill. If you're a yipper in the past, is not what I look forward to, because you need to be active with your hands. And I yipped that 10 footer so hard back up the hill, and it went right in the middle of the hole. But I remember I shot like 43 on the front, and I was just shaking the whole time I played. And I'm making the turn, and John Drace, who works in the pro shop at Shadow Ridge, just said, "Hey, how you playing?" And I just said, "Man, I don't know what it is. I'm shaking. I can't calm down." And he looked at me and he gave me the signal to go get a beer.
Yes.
I'm not a big drinker. Like I don't like the taste of it. It makes you fat. Like it gives you a headache. Like I really don't like to drink, but I went and got like two Coors Lights, and I took a sip on the 10th tee, and I felt my shoulders, like my shoulders were like above my ears, and I literally felt them fall, you know, like, and on the back I shot 38, but I had a triple, and like I hit a, it was actually really unlucky, like I hit a big boulder left of the fairway on 11, and I lost the ball, so I made 7 on 11, but I shot 38. So I shot 81 after I shot 43 on the front, just yipping everything. The next day, I just was like, okay, I just need to have a drink and just calm down. And I shot like 73, you know, and it was just like, oh my God, I was able to play like normally, you know, I was able to just enjoy myself. And then day 3 is when you think you figured it out. So I was like, oh, I just need a drink. So I got like hammered, which I should not have done, because that was diminishing returns, right? So I think I shot like 83 again. So that was when I learned, you know, like I just need a little bit to just, you know, steady my nerves, calm my hands. And all I ever want to do is just play to my potential, like, and just be able to do what I know I'm capable of. And I've found that since. So when I play golf on Saturday with my buddies, with my brothers, you know, it's not a big deal. I don't get nervous. You know, when I play competitively, I still need to have like a Bloody Mary before I get to the first green, but you just sort of, and you know, I never drink in any other circumstance. It's only to play competitive golf.
Well, I mean that, you know, maybe some of these guys on tour might need to think about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Do. I don't know if it is.
I kind of love this. You're like a golfer's golfer, but I also get a sense that your life has been a series of chapters that have gotten you to the place you are now. And I think allows you to appreciate in different ways, rather than being hyper-focused on one thing for an extremely long time. So, you know, I do want to dive into college. You're a big Oregon guy. Listen, yeah. I went through the Twitter, man. It is a bevy of OSU hatred. And I don't mean Oregon State. It is a lot of baseball. A lot of fun there. Tell me about Oregon. Why Oregon, and how much fun did you have there?
I never would have ended up at Oregon were it not for my dad and were it not for my older brother. So my dad, let me start with my older brother. So as I mentioned, I'm the baby. So I have my two older brothers, and they both went away to school. They both played collegiately at the University of San Francisco, which is a great school and honestly a very good golf team. But I saw when they left, USF is not a place that's just like it. Like there's no football team. The basketball team is an unbelievable history with like Bill Russell and titles in the 1950s and all this, but they're never going to win a national title. Right. And they're not into it. Right. And I also remember just growing up every Saturday in our household, we'd go play golf in the morning, and my dad would always park himself in his recliner to watch Wisconsin football. Right. So like, he has that association for the rest of his life that he will always be able to enjoy Wisconsin football for the rest of his life. And I was able to see my older brothers, you know, go to a small school that sort of doesn't, I mean, they watch USF basketball, sure, but like there's a level of relevance in terms of like the national landscape of it all. So like, I always knew I wasn't going to play professional golf. I certainly knew that because my hands were shaking every time I hit a putt. So like, I knew that wasn't in the future for me. So I started looking at, like, in those days, I can't remember if it was the Pac-10 or Pac-12, but I knew I just wanted like a school that was into athletics. Cause I love sports. Like all I'm thinking about all day is like the D-backs play the Mets at 4 o'clock, you know, we're starting an East Coast trip. We're playing the Mets and Phillies, and then we come home and play the Dodgers. So like, what a 10 game stretch, right? It's going to be brutal. So like I knew I wanted a long-term association with a team. I also knew I wanted to go a little bit further from home. Like I wanted to go far away from home where I couldn't just like easily come home for a weekend. Like my brother's San Francisco is like 7-8 hour drive north of North County, San Diego. So if they wanted to, they could. They'd have to really want to come back. But I sort of wanted to leave the nest. And then Oregon, I'm not here to tell you like I'm a Rhodes Scholar. It's not a really hard school to get into. The educational component is improving, I suppose, but I wanted to go to a place that was obsessed with athletics, a bigger school environment that was a little bit further from home. And Oregon checked every box. And I'm convinced to this day, it's the best decision I ever made.
And now you're insufferable on Saturdays, it's right?
Beyond that, yeah. It's pretty tough. Yeah, I've got literally a picture of Marcus Mariota, like a portrait, over my door. So he just watches over me the whole day as I work. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, I got to say it because being in Ohio here, we watched the same game a couple months ago.
Yeah.
I'm not a big OSU guy. I'm trying. I've heard it's good to be a fan of the state you live in, but that must have been a tough one, eh?
I'll say this, Dan, the silver lining of that, I made the mistake of driving up to Pasadena and attending that game in person with about 20 of my college buddies. The silver lining of it all is I beat the traffic leaving because I think I left at the end of the third quarter. So that was brutal. One of our best customers is a Buckeye, and he and I, we go back and forth constantly. And I just remind him, hey, in the year of 2025, we're actually 1-1 against you guys because we beat him in the regular season.
So. Yeah, that was the big rematch, the big redemption game.
I'm hanging on to that. I know, yeah, but it hurt.
It also felt like the national title game. Let's be honest here. Everything else is pretty pedestrian from there.
Yeah.
So Oregon was fun. You loved it. And then you ended up doing marketing for a baseball team for quite a few years. What was that like?
Yeah. So literally my entire life, I was born in 92. I'm a diehard Diamondback fan. I can't say I've been a Diamondback fan my whole life because their inaugural season was 98. So I was 6 years old when they started. Right. So in 1998, I was on their team in Little League. And I just started following the big club. And as you follow the big club in 1999, they won like 100 games. In 2000, they were great. In 2001, that's when they won the World Series against the Yankees. Mariano Rivera, Luis Gonzalez, bloop single into center field to walk it off. And I remember I was 9 years old and I was like in the fetal position on the couch, you know, as Mariano came in, he was coming in for a 6-out save. And in the eighth, he went 1-2-3. And then in the ninth, it's like, this is so dead. You know, it's just so dead. But anyway, I became a massive, massive, massive Diamondback fan. And when I was in college, I just started like somehow making some connections with the Diamondbacks, like people in the facility. And my spring break senior year, I somehow landed an interview with them. So I flew down to Phoenix and I interviewed with the Diamondbacks for a role and it went well. And they were like, hey, we're going to refer you to, we have a minor league baseball team. One of our minor league affiliates is just outside Eugene, not just outside, but 2 hours north of Eugene in Hillsborough. We're going to connect you with them. So they connected me with the general manager of the Hillsborough Hops, a guy named Kale Wambacher. I drove up, I interviewed with him, and I got a job as an intern. And when you're an intern for a minor league baseball team, I mean, there's like, if you think you understand work ethic, you just like, if you didn't before, after that, you do, right? So I graduated from college on June 16th, 2014. My first day with them was June 18th, 2014, which happened to be opening day. So I showed up literally on opening day, introducing myself to people, learning people's names. And then you're just in it from like 8 a.m. to it was a 7:05 first pitch until 10:05. There was fireworks on the field afterwards. And then in those days, we had to go to the fields and clean up the firework mess afterwards. So like literally my first day of work, 2 days after graduation, from 9 a.m. to 1 a.m., right? And like I loved it. You know, like I loved every second of it. Internship went great. They hired me into a full-time role afterwards where my job was actually to sell season tickets. And that's when you're calling hardware stores in Portland, you're calling, you know, insurance firms and all these places, just trying to get a meeting to share your experience and get people excited about baseball, which is really hard to do when it's 38 degrees and raining in December, right? And
sure,
you know, you have to visualize it, right? Opportunities go to revenue producers. I did really well in a sales role in the many years I was there. And as I grew in my sort of sales performance, I got the opportunity to work directly with the players and with the team. So like I started out as just a ticket sales guy. And then by the time I left, I was the director of communications and player relations. And that was when I got to know Dalton Barshow, you know, and that was when Paven Smith, who's hitting a homer every night for the Diamondbacks, right? And Geraldo Perdomo came through while I was there. So like all these guys were guys that I worked with when I was, you know, 24, 25 years old. That are now playing for the big club, right? So that was how I ended up in baseball. It's just like if there's a passion in my life, truly, it's baseball. I still get like a lightness in my chest when I see a baseball field, when you go to a baseball game and you know you're peeking through the concourse and you see the green field. I still feel it. Like I could get goosebumps thinking about that. That's what I truly, truly love to do. Now, obviously, you can carry simultaneous additional passions beyond one. So I'm also passionate about my family and about this name on my chest here. So while I probably prefer to go to a baseball game every day over like building putters every day, both are fine. Right. So I enjoy both. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. You mentioned the success they had when you were a young kid. And I've talked about this a lot because my first passion in life was the Blue Jays, and that when I was about the same age that you're talking about, that's when they won their World Series. Yeah. And I remember I had
an amazing World Series, you know.
And I had the sweatpants, I had the sweatshirt, I had the book bag, I had a face painting. Like it was all in, you know. And it's hard to, so being that I'm an export and now live in a different city, we talk all the time about how do you become passionate about something? And I think you need to get a spark to be given a reason. Yeah. So I've been sitting waiting for the Reds to do something for a long time.
And they got a nice young team.
It is curious now, and I'm hoping for that for my son, Cal. But we'll see. I do want to slide in post. I would talk baseball with you all day, but sure. I feel like people are curious about a little bit more. Yeah. It's interesting the way you describe these things and the passion you have around it. How did you end up getting back into or just getting into golf after the success you had?
Yeah, it was never the plan. I don't know how much people know what I'll tell you next, but August 20th, 2018, I called my mom. Cause she was, 2 days later, her and my dad were going to fly up to Hillsboro to, they would come see me a couple weekends a year. And they were coming up, the Hops were in town for a week. So, I'm driving back. I remember everything about this day. I'm driving back from, picking up lunch. I remember the road I was on. I remember the intersection I was going through, but I called my mom August 20th to tell her, hey, I got you tickets right behind home plate in like the all you can eat club section. It's going to be like unbelievable. Right. And my mom, she answered the phone. I could tell she'd been crying. I said, what's going on? And that's when she told me that she had just gotten out of the doctor's office. She had been diagnosed with kidney cancer. And I remember every moment of that day. And I'm like, they don't tell you what to do right after your mom tells you that she has cancer. And so I'm driving back to the office just like completely in a daze. And we had just a massive, massive parking lot around the stadium. And I'm still talking to my mom and I'm probably driving like every inch of this parking lot. Right. And then you get out of I get out of the car and I'm like about to walk into the front office just after hearing this news. It just is like earth shattering. Right. And there was a bench right outside the front door of the office. And I just remember like, I can't go in and face these people, right? And go in to like resume your normal day getting ready for a baseball game. I just remember I sat on this bench outside the office and I put my head in my hands. I just didn't know what to do. And that was when I'll never forget Amy Stone, wherever you are, Amy, but she saw me on the bench and sat next to me and she was the first person I told, and she just, you know, enveloped me in a hug and, you know, you're so grateful for you know, the angels you get in these unforeseen moments, right? But basically, my parents did not make the trip. Instead, I booked a ticket. I flew home. That was August 20, 2018. I flew home, and we were talking through treatment options with my mom. The cancer she had, it was kidney cancer, and they had discovered a tumor the size of a grapefruit engulfing her left kidney. I learned a lot about kidney cancer in this time. Thankfully, of all the cancers to get, it's one of the most treatable, because the kidney has a massive layer of tissue around it. So typically cancer is pretty comfortable in there. It doesn't get out that often. Thankfully hers hadn't left. So we scheduled a surgery for her on August 28th. So when I had flown down to see her after the diagnosis, I flew back to work the 8-game homestand, because minor league baseball, that's what you do. And then I flew back home like at 10 p.m. August 27th. I landed at like midnight, and my mom's appointment time in the OR, we had to drop her off at 5 a.m. for like a whatever 9 a.m. Surgery that was supposed to take 8 hours, right? So I got home at midnight. By the time I'm asleep, it's 1:30, and then me and my dad are up at 4:30 to take my mom to the hospital to wheel her into the operating room, right? You know, that's another day I'll never forget. August 28, 2018 is me and my dad, my mom's on the big gurney, and we stretcher her in like through the doors, where that's where you stop and that's where she's with the doctors, and it's out of your hands, right? I remember in that time, I was so thankful that I had made it home to wheel my mom in and, you know, wish her luck and, you know, say a prayer. Another thing they don't tell you about is, how do you get in the car and drive home after you've just wheeled your mom in? And for my dad, what he didn't realize, like I left that day more thankful I'd come home for my dad, because my dad was like a total complete wreck. And like he couldn't function. And I remember we got in the car and I drove home, right? And he was in the passenger seat, and I had to be there for him in that moment. So surgery went great. She was in the hospital for a couple of days afterwards. And then we got a phone call on September 1st from the doctor. This never happens, right? That she was completely cancer free. The cancer was completely engulfed and confined in that area. It hadn't spread into any part of her body. So like there's a measure of guilt, right? Cause so many families, like it's so many worse calls, right? Like why were we the family that got like the 8-day cancer battle? Right. Like that's so fortunate. Right. So she was diagnosed August 20th, had surgery on the 28th, and was cancer free September 1st. And I don't know if you ever, if in the course of your research, as you were stalking me on the internet, if you went through my Instagram, I hope you didn't. But there's a picture on Instagram, and I'll hold it up. But this is literally that's the like literally moments after we got the news, right, that she was cancer free. And I just remember like we got the call, and like so much silence came over. Like really, it's over? And then I just said to my dad, "It's like, I guess I'll go get some champagne." And I just like, I left and I went to the liquor store and I bought some champagne for everybody. But long way of answering the question, that sort of an experience like that shuffles your priorities. At that moment, I was the only member of my family not in San Diego. I was in Oregon. Both my two brothers were 15 minutes away from my parents at all times. And I'm very close with both my brothers. I'm very close with my mom and dad. So it was like, that was when I first started to think about coming home. And this is where I took it for granted earlier, but this is where that network of people I grew up with, you know, in my family, Mark King had just taken the job at Honma. He was running Honma, and he knew what I was going through with everything with my mom. And he's like, "Hey, we got to bring you home." He called me, he offered me a job to come down to work at Honma, and I told my boss up in Hillsborough that I was going home, and it was a tearful, sad conversation. I remain very close with him to this day. I loved that job and I love baseball, but my other passion was my family. So at that time I moved home to be closer to my family and spend time, but I still didn't want to go work for my dad, because it's a shadow. It's a long shadow. So I went and worked with Mark and Kawaja at Hanma Golf for a long time. Yeah.
So Hanma, I mean, first of all, what an amazing story. You know, I think a lot about how you said you wanted to leave and go and spread your wings a little bit. And then you kind of get wrapped up, as you mentioned, in the success of your future. And time goes by and suddenly you get reined back in and realize where you belong. You know, that's I've dealt with thoughts of that for a big part of my life. So it really hits home. But it also comes back to this conversation about golf and the sort of family that it becomes in other ways too, not just in a direct family, but the people you connect with. And I get that a lot. I think of your dad in a very special way, considering our friendship extends, I think, almost 10 years now. And it's like, you know, it's just a cool thing that people genuinely care in that industry about the success of everyone, not just the success of themselves, which is pretty freaking rare now in this world, you know?
Yeah, it's I think that's what our company sort of does best. And sorry, we're a small business, so we get phone calls.
That's all right, man.
But I think that's what our company does best. I think everyone wants to feel like they matter. And like our goal is to like, we're going to show you that you matter. You know, like you do matter. Like I don't have a lot of money. Like, so I look at what our putters cost. Right. And I'm like, it's a big purchase for somebody. Right. And I want to be there to like usher people and shepherd people through any part of the process, any question that they have so that they feel at ease about this investment that they're making in a piece of equipment. Right. So I think it's so rare in probably service these days to be shown how much you matter on a daily basis. But that is so sincere and real from our family to the people we work with. And then, you know, people like you, Dan, who are also in our network, right. In our immediate golf family, right. Like it's so much more than just saying you matter. We have to show people that they matter constantly. And that's just never far from the front of our minds.
Well, I have this debate with people a lot and they ask me, why do you feel so strongly about some brands and why do you feel so indifferent or sort of pessimistic about others? And I ask them all the time, I said, what do you get out of this? And they say the things they care about. And typically my response is, well, I'm looking for something a bit more. I know most products can hit the ball relatively straight. I know most companies can create a putter that hits the ball relatively well. Sometimes you're looking for more than that. And I think that's a really interesting point with what you guys are doing, because it is a premium product and there is a level of expectation that comes with that. Now, the fact that you actually accommodate it and don't, you know, throw all the bells and whistles ahead of the thing that matters most, which is the connection. I mean, we've scheduled this call very specifically based on the willingness to work with your customers on all other days. And I love that. Honestly, it's such a cool thing. So I want to dive into Toulon as a whole. And okay. I want to ask you specifically, since you've seen all these other components, worked at a couple different companies, what is it about Toulon that drives you? What is it about Toulon that gets you into the office every day and excited about what you're doing?
Yeah. There's a lot of things. There's so many opportunities here. The best way to explain it is sort of through the lens of my time at Mitsubishi. I worked at Mitsubishi for many years, sort of running the marketing team there, which was, it was great. The thing about Mitsubishi is it's a 40,000 person, company. And to do anything required about 11 layers of permission and sign-offs, and wonderful company, but it absolutely stifles creativity, right? So like there, nowadays here at Toulon, if there's something we want to do, it's let's do it, right? You don't have to get a ton of sign-off. Like I could not do Mitsubishi at an angle. I couldn't do it in blue. I couldn't do it in any other font. And now like I don't think we've ever done Toulon in the, like, here's a head cover with Toulon in bright pink and, you know, cherry blossoms. And it's got, like, Toru can tell you the story, but it's got like these three symbols of Japanese luck and fortune on it. Right. Didn't have to get any approval on that one. Right. So, so I think it's a, the creativity that's, just the ability to pursue the things that actually get you excited, without like the bureaucratic, stuff that surrounds it when you get into like these monolithic corporations. So having that measure of independence is like wonderful, right? That you can actually pursue things that you know are cool and get you excited. The second thing is building something that's ours is having some measure of autonomy and self-determination in your own life, right? So like, you know, I've worked at desk jobs at various golf club, golf component companies, and I'm on a million different group chats with a million different buddies. And, you know, you get a text on occasion like, hey, who wants to play Wednesday at 10 a.m.? I'm like, how the hell can people play Wednesday at 10 a.m.? You know, like what do you guys do? I just remember thinking like at some point I'd love to be in a role where I could say yes to something like that on occasion, right? Where I'm not so tethered to my desk. And it's not that I'm tethered, but I just have a you know, weekly responsibilities like Mitsubishi, we got a 10 a.m. call every Wednesday, right? Can't miss that. So I wanted some measure of autonomy in my life as well, that, you know, on occasion when that, you know, comes up, like you can say yes to some stuff like that. And you can I just wanted to take some control of my life, right? And not just be like living in such a rigid structure every Monday through Friday until you retire and die, right? Like that's not what I wanted to do. So like perfect example, tomorrow night, it's I'm flying to Vegas. I'm not looking forward to this for my buddy's bachelor party, which if in your mid 30s going to Vegas, like I'm good, you know, but we're going to have some fun. And but I didn't need to put in a PTO request, right? Just, hey, Dad, I'm going to be gone Thursday, Friday. You know, we'll get as much done as we can these first couple of days, but, you know, you'll be here with just the rest of the team Thursday, Friday, right? So, but that's the sort of stuff you wanted to pursue. And I'm not interested in building an empire and, you know, owning five homes. And I just want to be able to, on occasion, say yes to play golf with my buddies at 11 a.m. on a Wednesday. Like literally that's what I'm looking for. I don't need to get rich. Like I don't need fancy cars. Like I just want the ability to say yes to life experience. Right.
Yeah. I mean, being rich or being wealthy is defined in many different ways, not always monetary. Exactly. And it seems like there's a lot of wealth in your time that with your family and your friends. So definitely, that's really cool. I have a question, since every time I get your dad on here, or as most people know him, Sean, we talk about putter design and sort of his level of obsession with it.
Yeah.
My question to you is, do you need to be a putter expert to be potent at a putter company, or is there a freedom to do other things alongside it?
I'd say it helps. I don't have any semblance of a shred of the expertise that he has in putter design and golf club equipment. I mean, he's worked in golf longer than I've been alive, right? So like, I can't sit here and pretend to have, you know, this much of the talent and experience that he does. What I do have are probably some complementary strengths that he absolutely does not have. He's very entrepreneurial and he's very creative. If he has an idea, he starts right now, you know, which is great. If like you, man, that I can't reach that box, we need a ladder, I'll go to Home Depot and buy a ladder. You know, if it's, you know, to design the 2027 product line and you just, you know, start, probably need to have some conversations before we get going. Right. So like I can be more of the process oriented, you know, like, I don't know what the left brain, right brain deal is, but whatever it is, we're of the opposites. I guess to answer your question, no, you don't need to be. I wouldn't say like, I'm not a putter design expert. I'm certainly a putter expert. Like I'm qualified to talk about, you know, toe hang and, you know, putter shapes and MOI and forgiveness and all this stuff. And I can talk about that till, you know, the cows come home. I couldn't tell you about edges, blends, radii, chamfers, all the stuff that really gets my dad excited, but I can make the hell out of a product calendar, you know, and he can't. So, we have complementary strengths that, together, turns into a decent company.
It makes it pretty lethal, honestly. I think a lot about your background, and you're talking about selling baseball games in December. Yeah. You have to imagine what it could be. And I think when I was following along with the 2025 catalog, there's a lot of discussion about presentation. And I know mm-hmm. that while someone may not be able to describe what it takes to build a putter, they can certainly describe what it takes for their ideal presentation. Yeah. Things like finish or you guys talk a lot about your different what are they called, the face milling, the big tuna and some of that stuff. Like, a lot of that is about connecting people and the things they want to the products that are so spectacular. I feel like being in the part of that room where you have a lot of different creative minds and common sense minds or whatever you want to call it, it's got to be really fun. That has to be a part that really drives you guys.
You need both. You need dreamers, and then you need, you know, the practical element. So you need dreamers and you need definers, right? People that define the boundaries and the conversation, and does this really make sense? And is this something we can pull off? And yeah, will this work? Right. So, my dad always, he told me something growing up, like if people in the same room do the same things, then you really only need one of those people, you know, like, if you surround yourself with eight people that agree with you, then you really only need one of them. Right. So I think it's important to disagree. And I think it's important to just like understand your strengths and your weaknesses too. Like I'm not going to tell my dad how to design a putter the same way he's not going to tell me, you know, like what date we need the head covers in, you know, like, so it's together, like between the sum of our parts discussion, right? It's together. We're far, far better. And there's room for both. Yeah. There's need for both, you know? When you're at those tables, there's moments where it's like, man, we're cooking on something here. The thing that came together, I think the best when I think about it is like our Two Lunded Sons Scotland small batch last year. That was a meeting where we left, like that was good. You know, that was, that worked, you know, like everything worked. It's not always that way. But it's really fun when it works.
Yeah. Well, to your point, if you agree enough to where there's no disagreements, there's not a lot of point in having the discussion. It just is what it is.
There needs to be a measure of friction at all times.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Who do you think out of all you guys has the most inclination to be the friction?
Depends on the day. You spend a lot of time with family, right? Like if you've been around a Thanksgiving table on occasion, you're going to want to strangle somebody, right? So our family's no different. I would say probably there are equal opportunities of everyone pissing everybody off at various times, right? So like there's probably times where I put my foot down, we don't have time. And then there are times, you know, Tony or my dad or John on occasion steps in, which is great because he's like the voice of reason who's not a family member. It's like, thank you, John. There's times where we're all the culprit.
Tell me a bit more about the other things. Like you're wearing a really cool looking Toulon shirt right now, or a sweatshirt right now. Like there's a lot of additional components that go into what seems to be a 2025 putter company, whether that's accessories or apparel, or I've seen towels floating around. Like, how does all that come together?
Yeah, it's all part of it, right? So, I mean, you look at any golf equipment company, certainly like a boutique putter company, you know, if people really like the brand, they want things beyond the hard good, you know. This is really cool. This is our Japanese distributor wanted to make some apparel. So this is like literally the the Japanese sweater. It's the first time I've ever worn a large, you know, this is a large. So it was nice. Yeah, we make towels, we make head covers, we make hats and, you know, all that stuff. And it's just stuff that, like, it's most common among, like, our ardent supporters who just, like, they want to be, like, decked out head to toe Toulon. But it's also, it helps you just kind of create synergy between them and then between the hard goods and the soft goods. But then it's also, like, you know, every time we launch a head cover, like, it dramatically increases website traffic, right? And then when you dramatically increase website traffic, you know, more people look at putters, and when you more people look at putters, occasionally you convert, right? So, like, all of it is, you know, to get people into our store to shop around, experience our brand, and then, you know, if they if it ends up in an interaction with us, ideally we, you know, build a customer for life and show them they matter and treat people well, and with the we're all consumers ourselves. I would want to be treated as a consumer the way we treat our customers. You know, okay. That's always what I think about.
Yeah. Well, we've seen various companies who maybe start or talk about being a putter manufacturer who end up selling more trinkets or head covers than they do putters. Is there ever a concern or a desire to shift the amount of activity one way or the other?
We're a putter company, and you know, companies that have, you know, start maybe with one goal in mind and end with another goal, that's fine. You know, that's like the course of your, you got more information, you learned and you adjusted, right? So, you know, I always say how we look today is different than how we'll look 100 days from now. You get more information, you adjust and you improve, right? So I don't ever see us moving into, you know, anything other than putters. I mean, we'll probably do more hard goods eventually in the future, you know, expand into different categories. That's so far undefined at this point because we need to prove that we can. I want to focus on the easy things first and get those just absolutely down and make sure that we're focused on the right things, which is, that's a Sean thing on occasion. He just gets very excited and he goes in different directions, and that's good. You need those dreamers, but we also need the measure of practicality at times too. So we're a better company. Yeah.
There's also a level of challenge that anything you send out the door has to be of equal quality or better than the thing you're most proud of, which is your putters, right? So if someone gets, let's say a head cover or a towel, and it just doesn't meet their expectations, they're probably not going to go look at something more expensive like a putter, right? So there's got to be a lot of careful decision making there too.
And who can blame them? You know, it's yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you, when you get an email from people, you know, at the info email, and it's someone who's disappointed, like it like legitimately, it makes your heart sink. You know, like, man, that sucks. You know, you don't ever want someone to associate anything negative with your brand. You'll never be able to keep everyone 100% happy at all times, but we want to get as close to 100% as we possibly can. And, you know, if that means you can't cut corners, that means everything gets the attention that it requires, needs, deserves. Because there's just nothing worse than when you get a note from a customer, man, this came in a half inch short. Like, that sucks, you know, like it absolutely sucks, you know, or hey, this head cover keeps falling off, you know, like the little things suck equally, you know. So if you're gonna sell expensive stuff, you better be ready to support it and understand the burden that comes with it. Is to, yeah, you gotta be buttoned up at all times and make sure that people are getting exactly what they paid for and exactly what they deserve, and that's absolutely fair.
Well, let's talk about putters for a little bit, because you know, we've explored your world a lot, and it's been super fun to get to know you a bit more. I think everyone will enjoy that component of it. But you know, 2025 is a big release. There's way too many mallets in your lineup from my vantage point. I know you are secretly a blade guy. It's not hidden in a lot of the office putters that I've seen in videos. Yeah. But there is some rumors that what were you messing with, like a Carlsbad for this year?
Yeah, it's in the corner over there now. I tried so hard, man. I miss them right. I miss mallets right. I don't know why. Like I know scientifically, I know I'm supposed to be a better putter with a mallet. I'm just not. So
Well, there is a very evident shift in the putter world that putters are definitely leaning mallet lately. It doesn't seem like an awkward decision anymore to be a mallet guy.
No.
Whether or not you and I agree with it. So tell me about 2025. How excited are you guys with all the heads coming out, all the options for golfers? It has to be really fun, especially when people come in and try them locally and you get to see them make putts.
Yeah, no, it's been great. As a blade guy, it is a little bit painful. You see all the mallets, especially when people do come in locally, because we've got our fitting center open now. So we got Quintic and Sam and a Perfection Platform articulating putting green, which is really cool. Swing Catalyst cameras. It's like more than anyone could possibly need. But it's funny when people show up and they see the 20 putters on the wall, and it's like, man, that is overwhelming, right? To see the amount of options at your disposal. But it's been great. We weren't sure breaking back independent what it was going to be, right? We are now, we're coming up on 2 years on our own. And I don't know if people know this, but it's by far the longest we've ever been independent, right? Like, I mean, when we were founded in 2015, we were acquired 10 months in, right? So, or 10, 11 months in by Callaway. I think on the outset, we are 10 years old, we're coming up on 10 years old, but as a, on its own brand, we're three, you know, we're not even three, you know, we're coming up on three, where it is just the five of us, the six of us, doing it all. So it's great. We're learning a lot. But 2025 has been great. It's the year of the mallet. We make what golfers buy, man. It's mallets to blades are like 75-25. So it's unbelievable. You know, if we would make more blades if people were interested in blades, they're just not.
Isn't it tragic? Didn't you just hate it?
It's who am I to say, man? Like, my opinion doesn't matter. But I love blades. I recently went back. You know, everyone's got a putter they can't shake. I built up a Madison last year that I can't shake. But 2025, really? I didn't launch a Madison because no one buys blades, right? So I have to go back in time to find a blade I like, you know? But it's the world's changing. That's okay.
I've been an Austin guy for a long time, so I feel your pain. I want to know your perspective on steel options, because one of the things that I get really wrapped up in when I use a putter, or maybe the most important thing to me, is the profile that it gives me on contact. There are things I'm pursuing, and I've had the privilege of rolling James Miles, our good buddy, has a couple of your small batch, which has the 904L in it, and it's just absolutely lavish. I don't have a better way of describing it. It's absolutely lavish to roll. So, now, what's that like, going around messing with either old products like a Madison or something new with like really high end steel in it? What is that like for you, and how does it how do you react as a golfer?
Yeah, it's this is probably the thing I've always been worst at. Is I'm not super perceptive, and even going back to like the shaft days, when I would do shaft testing, you know, so like when we're developing sixth generation Diamana and we're hitting like six different profiles and they're asking me my thought, because they'd always ask, you know, the decent players, and I'm like a zero. So like I go and I hit these six shafts and it's like, that one felt like the last one, you know, and that one also felt like the last. I'm like the least helpful person. I'm just not, I've never been super clued into that. With all the different alloys, I always feel like the 904 stuff, it feels just a hair firmer to me. Mm-hmm. Like I noticed it with Tulsa. So I used Tulsa for a while. And I was expecting the sound and feel to be softer, and it was a little bit louder, and a little bit clickier than I was expecting. And it wasn't bad, but I was expecting different.
Really?
I went back to, I didn't go back to my Madison for any reason other than like, it's just home, you know? So like it's a different face milling pattern. And I think maybe that is what I pick up on more is the differences in face milling patterns. So like that was the mid depth double fly cut face mill. And I memorized that because I'd shot every video where it's like mid depth double fly cut face. And I messed it up every time. So I've got it down now, thankfully. And now that product line is not even around anymore. And then the 25 is the deep tuna. And that to me feels softer and plusher, and it is just a deeper depth to it, which, and it is a different material alloy. That's 304 this year versus 303 last year. So I wish I could tell you, like, from personal experience, like, man, it's, if you are clued into it, absolutely you'll pick up on differences. But like for me, man, I'm not that emotional about that. I should probably be more so, but you know, I am who I am.
Well, I actually love that, because normally you get this conversation. I think it's the same with Sean, that he presents it a little bit more in my perspective. And he's very, very particular when it comes to that. Whereas not everyone's like that. So you have these discussions, like on THP, the community, we talk all the time about how a putter feels and, you know, trying to land on feel. When you mention the shaft thing, like trying to discuss four different shafts and the differences, not only is your perspective going to be different from other people, you might not feel it. So you know, the idea that there's an absolute in this process, I'm thrilled for you to say, not really for me.
Yeah.
That's cool.
For others, yes, though. You know, like, and then my dad is, you know, he's a romantic, and he's, I've told him my whole life, he's just like a walking Hallmark card. But he's like, he's very romantic and he's very sentimental. He believes what he's saying, you know, and he's sincere when he says it. The way I'm not perceptive, he is, you know, so, and that's within the same family, within the same bloodline. Right. So like, who knows? Right. And the one thing that sort of can frustrate me on occasion with forums is someone making a comment about feel and it being taken as an absolute. It's like those comments that people make have so much sway over people. Like, oh, interesting. That's what you felt, huh? It's like, well, man, like your mileage may vary, like, and it probably will, you know,
definitely will.
So it's great to share your perspective and your opinions. I would just always couch it, this is me, you know? So like, I can't tell. I'm not super perceptive. I'll say this: we wouldn't launch a putter that feels bad, you know.
Yeah, at least to Sean, anyway, right?
At least to Sean. Yeah, but when you hit a putter that sounds bad or feels bad, you know, like even I can tell, right? So we don't. That doesn't see the light of day.
Yeah. Sure. Well, tell me, my friend, if there is one thing that people could focus on when they looked at your brand or your company, or even you, and they're reaching out, what would it be?
I would just say it's like a legitimate sincerity to help. And I view it through the prism of I'm a consumer myself, and how would I want to be treated if I could, you know, if I could choose how I was treated. I say it to people all the time, every day, I'm thankful for how low a bar other companies set and how they interact with their customers. Right. When I interact with people, my cell phone number is in my email signature, and like I want people to know it's there to contact me, you know. So like, and so many people are uncomfortable, you know, like reaching out directly to people, but like I don't understand why so many companies insulate themselves from their customers, right? So if people don't buy putters, I don't have dinner, you know. Like that is sort of like, look, we're not going to sleep in the street. We're fine. Everything's great. Company's great, you know, but like, that is the prism I view things through. It's like, why would I not try to talk with my customers as much as I possibly can? So like, when I say like, hey, reach out to me, hey, let me know, like, we want to help you get into the putter that will help you. And then we also like, we are not like a, hey, once the order comes through, it's over with. Like, keep us posted, you know, let's keep in communication. If it needs any tweaks, you know where we work. If you want to send it in for any adjustments, you want to cut it down, you want to regrip it, you want to change loft lie, whatever, send it in. Like, we are full service, right? Like, we are a pit crew. I want people to feel like when they buy a putter from us, they're they're a part of our team, you know, and like there is like a, I told you, I don't want to just tell people we care because that doesn't mean anything if you don't back it up with any bit of action, right? Like, so we're desperate to show we care at all times. And you could ask anybody, you're going to, if you work with us, we're going to make sure you leave with something you love that you feel confident in that, that will work for you. So that's real.
That's awesome. It's everything that I've ever experienced from you guys. I absolutely believe that that's what people will receive. And I'm super hopeful to see the future continue to grow for you guys and do great things.
Yeah.
Tell me, I don't want any full on secrets, but can we get excited for Small Batch? Is some cool stuff coming?
Yeah. When's this coming out? When's this recording going live?
It'll be early, like at end of this week. So, okay. Yeah. Just early May.
Yeah. No, you'll start seeing, stuff for the May Small Batch. Honestly, probably right around the time this launches. It's called Charlotte. Lined up with the first round of the PGA Championship, Quail Hollow. Cool place. This putter will be like an ode to stock car racing because Charlotte is like the home of the NASCAR Hall of Fame and all sorts of cool things to do with like NASCAR and cool stock cars and all that stuff. And if you know anything about our family, it is automotive based. We love cars. The parallels and synergies between high performance auto racing and high performance milled putters there's some significant overlap there. So this is a cool one. And then the one in June, which I'm not going to tell you about right now, is like the coolest one of all time. I shouldn't have even said that because now you're going to, that's a mean thing to say to people.
I think it's great. Hey, listen, they've been paying attention to us for an hour. I think they've earned something, right?
Plenty of cool stuff on the horizon for sure.
Fantastic. Yeah. Preston, it was a blast today, buddy. Thanks for joining. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks, Dan. Anytime. Good to finally do this.
Yeah. Hey, if you guys are out there playing this weekend, have a good time. Check out Toulon Putters. They're pretty awesome, honestly. And they have like a 10-year history of just really interesting designs. You're bound to find something that works for you. Even if you're a mallet guy, I guess that's fine. Whatever. They got lots of options this year. We'll see you guys next week. Now it's time to send it over to Don Brown for this week's Shaft Education, brought to you by True Temper.
Hey everybody, it's Don Brown from True Temper here in our San Diego R&D facility. And quite aptly, this week's question for Shaft University is about handcrafted, and when can we get some more handcrafted stuff? So I'm not sure if you're talking about swag, head covers, hats, things of that nature. We're working on all that. If you're talking about shafts, we've obviously relaunched our handcrafted T1100. We got another one coming down the pipe here really soon that I know a lot of you OG hazardous guys are going to be very excited about, including the host of this podcast, Dan. So keep your eyes out on our socials here for the next few weeks and you'll see what I'm talking about. Thanks, guys. Have a good week.
THP Radio on the Hackers Paradise Podcast Network, your number one source for all things golf. Subscribe on iTunes to never miss an episode.